You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I am Charlotte Wagermiller. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, December 19th, 2017.
So a total of a little around $394 million reduction over the biennium compared to what they thought revenue would be in April of 2017.
Indiana State Budget Office says it overestimated its revenue for next year and 2019 by $400 million. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with the State Budget Director Jason Dudich about the funding shortfall in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Courtney Stewart and Stacey Guffinay discuss isolation during winter for seniors and those coping with disabilities. That's coming up on Everyday People, a weekly segment aimed at improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County. But first, your daily headlines.
The Indiana director of the Department of Child Services announced her resignation on Friday. In her resignation letter to Governor Eric Holcomb, Mary Beth Bonaventura stated, quote, "I am now in the untenable position of seeing Hoosier children being systematically placed at risk without the ability to help them. I feel I am unable to protect children because of the position taken by your staff to cut funding and services to children in the midst of the opioid crisis. I choose to resign rather than be complacent in decreasing the safety, permanency, and well-being of children who have nowhere else to turn," unquote. Bonaventura highlighted strife between her and the governor's office, which appointed Eric Miller as DCS's chief of staff. Bonaventura stated Miller had no child welfare experience and was appointed to the position because he, quote, was an asset during the campaign, unquote. In a press release issued yesterday, Governor Holcomb stated, quote, "I'm grateful for Director Bonaventura's years of service and her commitment to keeping Hoosier kids safe. I share that commitment, and that's why the state continues to make investments in the agency. We are providing record funding to the DCS with nearly $500 million more in funding support over the next 2 years. We will continue to do all we can to support children," unquote. Bonaventura's last day at the Department of Child Services is December 27th. A copy of her resignation letter will be available on WFHB's website following this broadcast.
Changes in the Environmental Protection Agency's toxicity standards mean the city of Bloomington will save money in remediating its Switchyard Park property. According to Parks Operations Director Dave Williams, the land was previously a railroad property for more than 120 years. Williams says as such, the Switchyard Park is contaminated with coal ash and cinder. Williams told the Bloomington Redevelopment Commission last night the city is working closely with the Indiana Department of Environmental Management to make sure the property is restored in a way that makes it safe for recreational use. But Williams says EPA remediation standards have changed since the city began designing the Switchyard Park in 2015.
Early on in the design, and this project design began in late 2015, the EPA standards called for substantial clean soil coverage over most of this property, and depending on whether it was going to be a location that the public would interact with the surface or the soil, such as concert lawns or the dog park.
Williams says the new rules reduce the number of inches of clean soil required for areas that will see direct public interaction.
Back in July, those coverages were substantial, upwards of a foot of imported dirt from other sites. The EPA has, in a process that apparently was well underway before the current administration, they have changed their cover requirements for the specific chemicals of concern found in the coal ash on this property. It will require much less soil coverage than was originally thought. And so our contract costs or construction estimate costs for imported dirt will decrease by over $600,000.
Williams says in July 2017, the EPA revised its allowable levels of some contaminants found in coal ash, namely benzopyrene and other polyaromatic hydrocarbons. Commission member Mary Alice Rickert questioned Williams about those changes.
In terms of the soil, the coverage, what's the science behind dropping that by half?
I don't know. And we were a little bit concerned.
I wouldn't say it was precisely
by half, but instead of 12 to 18 inches of cover, we're now at six to 12 in most areas. There'll be areas that are greater than 6 inches, but we are following the recommendations of IDEM and our consultant. Now, as to the, I think at the end of the day.
Those are independent of the new EPA administration.
The state is following the new EPA rules, and they're going a little bit beyond them, and we said, that's fine. We'll follow whatever you guys tell us are the standards and regulations that you want us to follow for the park. Now, keep in mind, too, some areas won't have any soil coverage, a basketball court, a paved trail. There's bocce ball courts. There's hard surfacing and other types of surfacing in the park that won't require dirt coverage because that protective cap will be an impervious surface that the public cannot interact with the soil. So the concert lawns will have a little bit thicker coverage because it'll be an open grass field versus the playground, which will be an entirely a rubberized surface over the top of it.
Commission member Suze Gambaluri joined Rickert in expressing concern about the EPA rules change. Williams says environmental consultants Bruce Carter Associates are guiding the city on this issue.
That's striking, the decrease. And I'm wondering if there's anything you could share about the history of those requirements going up and down.
Well, there is a...
just nationally. I mean, we've all been reading about the new EPA director and how dramatic the changes have been. And I just want to make sure that we continue to be really safe and be using science-based decisions.
That was the first question we asked. And we were told by Bruce Carter Associates that these rules were not codified, but put on the register for review well before the current presidential administration and well before the changes in EPA.
Williams says both IDEM staff and the consultants, Bruce Carter Associates, assure him the reduced soil coverage will not make the park less safe for the public.
It's all about risk to children, to adults, and based on their interactions with remediated soil. And if they have lowered the toxicity levels because of testing in other locations, that's deeper than what I have understood. We're just basically clearly following the directions from our consultant that this still will be a safe, compliant, environmental covenant protected property.
Says the city is committed to maintaining a high standard for soil remediation as it creates lands for public use.
Incidentally, the state awarded the Beeline Trail an environmental cleanup award, and in kind of a surprising chain of events, we recently received an EPA Region 5 award for remediation of the Beeline Trail. So we've set the bar pretty high on environmental cleanup of properties that will be restored to public use, and that is what we intend to do for Switchyard Park.
The city contracted with Rundell Ernstberger Associates to design the Switchyard Park for an amount not to exceed $2,410,000. The remediation discussion came as the Redevelopment Commission approved a $40,000 amendment to the design contract for additional services.
Indiana State Democrats have been putting together a legislative agenda for the 2018 legislative session. According to Senator Mark Stoops of Bloomington, livable wages and a higher minimum wage will be the centerpiece of the Democrats' legislation proposals for 2018.
One of the issues that we really need to deal with, or we feel it's very important, is the fact that we have many Hoosiers who are working full-time jobs, but they still don't have enough to live on. A big part of that problem is the level of the minimum wage right now. So, and also trying to get employers to pay more of a sustainable wage. So we're going to be working to raise the minimum wage.
Senate Democrats are also planning to work on giving voters easier access to polling places in the 2018 election. According to Stoops, Indiana has one of the lowest voter turnouts for state elections, an issue he contributes to a lack of easy access to voting locations.
We'd also like to work on extending hours for voting. So Indiana is one of the few states that cuts off voting at 6 o'clock, and I think that disadvantages working people because until we get vote centers, you pretty much have to get back to near where you live to vote. It's also difficult to send in a ballot, so we want to try to expand the ability to both register up to the day of election, because there's no reason you shouldn't be allowed to register up to the day of election, and also that you can send in absentee ballots without an excuse.
In addition to improving voter turnout, Senate Democrats will also be working on assembling a redistricting panel. The panel would be a bipartisan effort between Senate Democrats and Republicans. The goal of the panel will be to use information provided by the 2020 census to redraw district lines to be more reflective of local political demographics.
One of the things we'd like to try to work on this year is nonpartisan redistricting committee, so that after the census is done in 2020, we can actually have a nonpartisan panel that looks at the districts for your representatives. Right now, legislators basically pick who their voters are, who they want their voters to be. And we want the districts fairly set up so that we have fair elections.
Introducing new Democrat-led legislation will be difficult, according to Pierce. Republicans hold a strong majority in both the state House and Senate.
Well, it's always difficult. I won't try to kid anybody on that. You know, if the corporations that finance the Republican Party don't want it, then it's going to be very difficult to pass it.
The Indiana General Assembly will reconvene for the 2018 session on Wednesday, January 3rd.
The Community Foundation of Bloomington and Monroe County announced today that it received its single largest donation to date. According to a press release from the foundation, the $800,000 donation from Judy Feldposh will provide annual grants for Big Brothers, Big Sisters of South Central Indiana, Habitat for Humanity of Monroe County, the Monroe County Humane Society People and Animal Learning Services, the Monroe County American Red Cross, the Salvation Army of Bloomington, and Volunteers in Medicine. Feldposh lived in Bloomington from 1999 until 2013, after moving from Michigan, where her husband worked at Feldposh Grocery Chain. The Community Foundation issues grants to area agencies. It has reportedly granted over $25 million to over 400 local nonprofit agencies since its incorporation in 1990. It currently maintains a $32 million endowment. Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Charlotte Wager-Miller. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar energy, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The state of Indiana is in the process of revising its 2018 and 2019 budget to reflect corporate income tax reductions. The state will collect nearly $400 million less in revenue than it had previously anticipated. Over half of that loss of revenue is due to tax breaks and credits given to corporations in the state. Those tax benefits are set to continue into 2021. WFHB News Director Wes Martin spoke with State Budget Director Jason Dudich this afternoon. He says, although $400 million is a staggering amount, it still comprises only around 1% of the state budget and won't affect the state's $1.8 billion reserve.
Jason Dudich, State Budget Director.
Mr. Dudich, can you tell me a little bit about what the revised budget prediction ends up looking like?
The revenue
forecast technical committee presented to the state budget committee yesterday a revised revenue forecast from the April 2017 forecast. Much of the revision was in the corporate income tax area. For the last 5 months, we've seen a drop in our corporate income tax. And so the revised revenue forecast mostly updated corporate income tax based on the experience in the corporate tax area, which reduced the corporate tax projections from the April 2017 forecast to today. It also updated individual income tax. There was an adjustment by the Bureau of Economic Analysis on wage growth, and that base number that was assumed in April dropped a little bit to date. And so that revenue forecast also assumed the same amount of growth in Hoosier income, but a lower base, a lower starting base from where we thought we were in April. So those were the two biggest adjustments within the revenue forecast, a small adjustment in 2018 based on what we've experienced to date, and then a little under $220 million adjustment in 2019 based mostly on the corporate income tax changes that we've experienced to date and the lower base on the individual income tax side.
So all told, how much will we not be receiving?
Sure. In 2018, the updated forecast is $175.5 million less than what it was in April of 2017. So that's a reduction in the anticipated revenue for this year. In 2019, the second year of the biennium, they reduced the projections down $219.2 million in 2019 compared to forecast. So a total of a little around $394 million reduction over the biennium compared to what they thought revenue would be in April of 2017.
So both what they're considering revenue will be for 2018 and what they consider revenue might be for 2019, those estimates have dropped down significantly.
Significant is a good point, Wes. I want to make sure that the $175 million is just 1.1% reduction. So when we talk about, $15.5 billion, $175 million is an impact. It certainly does raise an eyebrow for us, but want to put things in perspective that if you compare the April forecast to the updated forecast that was presented yesterday, it's a reduction of 1.1% in 2018 and 1.4% in 2019. So a large dollar amount to some folks, but when you look at the overall big picture of the total revenue that the forecast encompasses, not a large on the percentage side, but still numbers that make us go back and make sure that we're spending effectively and efficiently and looking to make sure that we have good management reserves in place and focusing on the governor's goal to be at 11.5% in general fund reserves at the end of each fiscal year.
And Mr. Dudich, is this a problem of overestimation or is this a problem that some things didn't end up coming to fruition?
Yeah, I'd say two things. I would say on the corporate side, I think corporate and individual income is probably where we should look at, Wes. And these are projections. These were made back in April of 2017. On the corporate side, I think what we experienced was, one, we are processing returns faster than we had processed corporate income tax returns before. So there is a faster time period when returns are processed. So that is speeding up the time in which we're paying out refunds to corporations. The other thing is we are seeing a reduction in general federal taxable corporate income 2016-2017, which we did not have that information at the time. So with new information, certainly on the corporate side, Wes, it's just updated information that we've experienced over the last 5 months. Not a problem. Corporate's hard to nail down, but certainly one that there were some changes that we didn't expect to have a negative impact on the revenue, but we think we've gotten through most of that. The individual income tax side, that reduction of 2% of the base based on the Bureau of Economic Analysis, that was one that they just updated their forecast. They updated where they thought wages would be. And when we looked at those numbers back in April, they were what they were. And when we updated and used that information again, they had lowered their projections. So certainly a lot of this is just projection and using the the best information available at the time to make those projections. And that's why we do this exercise. We update these every December to make sure we're on track the first 6 months of the fiscal year. And if we're not, we go back and readjust those projections to make sure that our spending aligns with our revenue. So certainly puts a little bit of a hamper on how we're going to spend our dollars, but the reasons why they're occurring are reasons we can point to and have a legitimate understanding of why they're happening. So it doesn't cause us much angst in terms of why the revenues are down, since we understand the changes that occurred in the projected forecast.
Were the changes that occurred in the forecast, was that something that happened, or was this just we haven't seen the wage growth that we were expecting when it comes to individualized income? How exactly do we end up getting to $175.5 million less in predicted revenue in 2018 and $219 million less in 2019? Sure.
No, fair questions. On the corporation side, I would say that that is wholly due to a larger amount of refunds occurring for corporations than was expected, and also due to federal taxable income being down. So those are the main indicators there. Again, not something that we had understood back in April. The information we just didn't have, and so as revenue forecasts go, things change. So nothing that we didn't project correctly, just things that were out of our control happened in the last 5 months that we're now adjusting for in the forecast. So of the $175.5 million in the first year, 2018, that it went down, $174 million of that is in corporate. So you can see that corporate is the main driver of that reduction, mostly, again, due to how quickly returns are processed, lower federal taxable income, and then the amount of refunds that have been provided to corporations. So, again, something that we weren't thinking about in detail back in April, but certainly had it on our mind, but didn't think the magnitude of it would be this great. On 2019, of the $219 million, again, corporate is about $104 million of that. So, again, we're just being conservative for next year, assuming that that reduction in corporate continues through faster processing of returns and maybe more corporations exercising the ability to pull their refunds in. That federal taxable income piece was new to us when we had sat down and talked earlier the last couple of months. It wasn't something that we knew about back in March and April of 2017. The other part of that $219, $73 million of that is individual. Again, that's just based on changing the base. So Indiana wages continue to grow. In fact, we're projecting they will continue to grow in the next 18 months to 3 years for the state of Indiana for Hoosiers. It's just the formula that we use and the equation that we use. The Bureau of Economic Analysis reduced the base amount of wages by 2%, and we use that as our starting point. So it wasn't something that you can point to and say wages are down or earnings are down or unemployment is causing this. This was really a factor of the Bureau of Economic Analysis lowering their base estimate that we use to project our individual income tax.
Mr. Dudich, again, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us. Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know or Hoosiers should be aware of when it comes to this change in state budget calculation?
Certainly, it's an indicator that these are projections and they do change based on outside influences on our revenue. That's why we are prepared when we put together management reserves and spending plans for the state in order to account for swings like this so we're not caught off guard. And Governor Holcomb has been committed to keeping strong financial management in place along with strong financial reserves. And we're going to continue to focus on that so we end with a balanced budget. We always have balanced budgets. And we have been building a budget that reacts to changes in revenue, and this is one of those changes we anticipate. And we'll act accordingly and maintain strong fiscal discipline.
Jason Dudich, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Anytime, Wes. Thank you.
That was WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaking with State Budget Director Jason Dudich.
Support for WFHB comes from the Uptown Cafe, established in 1976, located at 102 East Kirkwood Avenue, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as wine, beer, spirits, and cocktails. More information is available at the-uptowncafe.com. Coming up next, WFHB's weekly community resources segment, Everyday People.
Don't mess around. Town.
Welcome to Everyday People, improving the lives of older adults and people with disabilities in Monroe County.
Everyday resources for everyday people. Connecting our community by sharing resources you need, want, and probably don't know about.
Hi, we're here today with Tim Clower from the Community Kitchen. Tim, can you tell us a little bit about the work that you do at the kitchen and about the Community Kitchen in general?
Well, Community Kitchen has been around since 1983, and it was started originally as just a soup kitchen that would provide a warm meal each day to people that needed meals. At the time, there were only really pantries in town, so there wasn't a place where folks could go and get prepared meals. So for over 30 years now, we've been providing that service Monday through Saturday from 4 o'clock until 6 o'clock. We serve a dinner meal. Over the years, we've increased our programming to include the most at-risk groups, which are children and the elderly. And last year, we served 277,000 meals.
Wow,
and
amazing.
About 60% of those meals went to kids, and about 15% went to seniors.
So people have to go to your location to get those meals, is that correct?
Yeah, we actually have two. Our main location is at 1515 South Rogers. And then we have a carryout location on 1100 West 11th Street on the corner up there.
Is there a qualification process, or do people just come and they...
It's totally anonymous. That's okay. One of the things we've always prided ourselves in. And the reason for that is we want to make it as easy as possible for folks to be able to get food if they need it. We do have a sign-in sheet.
Is it just to track the number of people that you're serving?
Yeah, it's okay. Just to track the warm bodies that come in to get food. That is required for some grants.
So we're doing this interview in the week before Christmas, and I know that this is a good time for people. They feel, you know, the seasonal love, and they're donating a lot, and they're wanting to volunteer. But I also know that the Community Kitchen needs assistance, you know, donations and volunteering year-round.
Well, we traditionally not only do a holiday meal, which this year we'll be doing on Christmas Eve, so we'll be doing a holiday meal. People can donate items for that meal. We do ham, we do green bean casserole, sweet potatoes, pie, rolls, cider, all your traditional holiday meal fare. So people can donate those things. They can donate grocery gift cards, which is helpful for us because we can pick up certain items we may not have gotten enough of. So we serve from 3 to 6 at both locations. We also are doing delivered meals to Area 10 clients and deliver usually around 150 meals.
Wow.
This year, in addition to the meal for Christmas Eve, which will be a warm holiday meal, we're also including an extra meal for folks to have the next day. So they won't necessarily have to go out to try to get a meal on Christmas Day. So we have volunteer shifts that day on Christmas Eve. I believe most of those are filled at this point. But we also can use help in the weeks following Christmas because we continue doing the same things every day that we do throughout the year.
You mentioned that people could donate food items. What type of food? And I'm asking specifically because I did an event yesterday and I have a ton of Christmas cookies left.
Yeah, anything that's been prepared in a commercial kitchen, you know, any prepared foods that have been store-bought or made in a commercial kitchen. But the main things as far as perishables, any type of canned vegetables or fruits we can use. We do our Backpack Buddies program for elementary kids. This week we'll take a break after this week for the holiday since kids aren't in school. But we're doing close to 300 backpacks a week that elementary kids can take home to supplement their family's food over the weekend.
Is that on a weekly basis?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Wow.
I had no idea the number was that high.
Yeah, we go to, I think, around 7 different schools, and kids that are signed up with the social worker on Fridays get a backpack of food to take home.
Oh, that is great.
Tim, thank you for being here, and thank you for the awesome work that you do with the Community Kitchen.
My pleasure.
You just give us a quick address for the main location and maybe the phone number if people want to see about donating or volunteering?
Yeah, our main address is 1515 South Rogers. Our mailing address is P.O. Box 3286, Bloomington, Indiana 47402. If you have any questions about donating or volunteering, our number is 812-332-0999. And you can just look for us at MonroeCommunityKitchen.com on the web.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tim.
Thanks for joining us on Everyday People.
Tune in next week for more information and resources that connect everyday people to everyday resources. For WFHB, I'm Courtney Stewart.
And I'm Stacey Goffinay.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Jonah Chester and Wes Martin, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
Everyday People is produced by Courtney Stewart and Stacey Goffinay. Our engineer is Megan Wade. Our theme music is provided by The Impossible Shapes. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Charlotte Wagermiller. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news at WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program, coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.